Welcome along to another D Word podcast where we talk dementia. We've covered the world of dementia carers a number of times on the podcast and really make no excuses for keeping on highlighting the difficulties the Forgotten Army face. My guest this week is Alison Milne, co-author of the book Family Carers and Caring, What's It All About? Well, Alison, it's great to welcome you as my guest here on the D Word on UK Health Radio. Lots to talk about. We're going to be talking about the book, Family Carers and Caring, What's It All About?, which hopefully we'll answer that question a little bit in the next 30 minutes or so. Before we get into to all of that, just tell me, you know, a little bit about the work that you do there at the University of Kent.
Okay, Pete, great to be here and thanks ever so much for inviting me. I was at the University of Kent for about 25 years. I mean, unbelievably, actually, but anyway, I was. And I got a sort of semi-retirement package in 2020. So I still have a lot of connections with the university and do bits of research and have, you know, friends and colleagues there, but I don't work full time for the university anymore. But I was latterly a full-time professor of social work and social gerontology and taught mainly social work students and have historically done research in the caring field, as is probably obvious from the book, mental health in later life, social work with older people and social care more generally, really, in relationship to older people.
We are going to talk about the book, as I said, Family Carers and Caring, What's It All About? First of all, very good read because it brings together a whole load of strands when we think about caring. And also, you know, I've got to say, academic books are not always readable, but that one...
I think that's a very fair comment, Pete, actually.
Okay. But your one is, that's what I was going to say, it is very readable and it produces a lot of thought. There's a lot of statistics in there, which I'll come on to in a minute, but also there's a lot of thought as well and a lot of things where kind of I finished reading and thinking, well, I've never really thought of it in that angle before. Which, you know, hopefully that's what it's meant to achieve. But, you know, I mean, where did the book come from? Why a book in the first place?
Happy to answer that. Just to say before I do that, I wrote the book with my colleague and friend, Professor Mary Larkin from the Open University, who unfortunately can't be with us today because we've done a couple of podcasts and we've kind of done it as a duo, which is very much the approach we took to writing the book. So I just want to sort of give a shout out to Mary there. It isn't an academic book, Pete. I mean, I think that's the first thing to say. It was never intended to be, as it were, an academic text. It very much is situated between, if you like, the academic world and the sort of and the intelligent reader who wants to know more about caring. So it's sort of it's academically informed, but it's not a sort of book necessarily situated squarely in what you might call the kind of usual academic frame. It's part of a series for Emerald Publishing have got a series called Society Now. And Society Now, as its name suggests, are a stable of books that look at issues that are very current and contemporary. So they've got books on selfies and that sort of thing. So this book fits into that umbrella. So it's an issue of contemporary interest to the public and generally wider society, which is not to suggest that it's not appropriate for students. I would say it would be a very good book for social work students to read, for nursing students, medical students even, students of health and social policy, health and social care, people training to be carers, people training to work in the health field, particularly if they're going to be working perhaps with people with disabilities or older people. I think it would be a very appropriate book. As you say, I hope it captures quite a lot of different elements of the sort of caring world. But that's where it fits in to the sort of publication panoply, if you like, where it's located.
Yeah, and it is a subject that, you know, gets a lot of newspaper headlines, gets a lot of talk about. We'll probably go on to the fact that probably sometimes not a lot gets done about. But just, you know, delving in there, and one of the things that came out of me is numbers. 26% of the adult population, with an adult population of over 60 million. I sort of began to add that up and thought that is one heck of a lot of people.
It's a hell of a lot of people, as you say, and that would actually have been another good title for the book, now I come to think of it, Pete. You know, caring, it affects a hell of a lot of people, and it certainly does. Well, I mean, let's unpick that a little bit. There are growing numbers of family carers. I'm going to use the word family, but I'm including in that friends too, because quite a lot of people are supported by friends and neighbours too. But or some people would say unpaid, which is absolutely true. Carers, family carers are completely unpaid. But I'm just going to use the term family carers so we all know where we're coming from. The numbers are growing, and that's for a number of reasons. One is that we are living in an ageing society, an ageing population. So there are more older people with long-term conditions, frailty, dementia, and so on, who often need support in the community from family members. There are also growing numbers, which is to be celebrated, of course, of younger adults with long-term, lifelong disabilities, quite possibly born perhaps with a disability or may have acquired it in childhood or due to a road traffic accident or something like that, who are living into midlife and way beyond, and also people with learning disabilities. So that's the second growing group. We've also, I think we've rather demonised care homes and long-term institutional care in ways that isn't always helpful. I'm not, by the way, suggesting that, you know, a lot of people don't want to go into a care home, and that's a fact. Most people don't want to. Some people do and feel safer and more secure in the care home. I think that's very important to say. But it's really reserved now for those in really very high levels of need. Whereas, you know, frankly, when I was a social worker in the 80s, you know, we used to have things called rest homes, where if you were nervous going out at night, you were beginning to feel quite isolated at home. You know, you had a sister perhaps in a local care home. You might want to go in and just not have the stress and strain of living on an unfriendly housing estate that you just didn't feel at home in anymore. Now, we haven't got those at all now, and we've got nursing homes and residential care homes who look after mainly very elderly people with complex needs. So I think that's the third issue. We've kind of pushed, the care home is very much on the edge of metaphorically and often physically on the edge of our communities, and is really reserved for those people in greatest need. So we've got a growing group of older people and people with long-term disabilities who need care. And if there isn't the care home there, and we have massively reduced investment in community-based care services too, that's the fourth element of this, then care needs don't disappear, do they, Pete? I mean, they're still there. So who picks up the care tab is what we're arguing in the book. Of course, it's the family who do that. So that's really the main reasons, plural, as to why we've got a growing number of older carers, including a growing number of older carers, which I'll perhaps come on to a bit later. But yes, you're right. You and I, well, I've actually was a carer for my mother. You know, a lot of middle-aged adults, in particular middle-aged daughters, can expect to look after their elderly parents or parents-in-law.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
My guest on the podcast this week is Alison Milne.
Probably, you know, I look back, I don't know, 20 years or whatever, and people considered to be carers, you would have thought there'd be a certain age profile because they would be looking after parents or whatever. But when you bring out those kind of statistics, people in their 20s should be taking note of this because it's going to be part of their world, isn't it?
It is going to be part of their world. Yes, you're absolutely right. The profile, what's called the ageing of caring. So not only is the population ageing, but there is also, if you like, it reflects or is mirrored by what's called the ageing of caring. So carers themselves are becoming an aging population, if you like. So we've now got more and more people in the 60s, 70s, 80s and beyond, believe it or not, who are looking after often another elderly person. So we've got growing groups of older spouses, and of course, older Well, it depends how you define older, but let's just say it's 65. You've got growing groups, a group now of daughters and sons, of course, too. Daughters-in-law and sons-in-law, who were looking after, who might be in their 60s, even late 60s, even early 70s, looking after extremely elderly parents and parents-in-law. So the profile of the group of people doing the caring is aging, as well as the group of people who are being supported. But you know, just to be clear, though, you know, there are lots and lots of middle-aged women particularly, but also men doing caring too. And there are, I definitely wouldn't want to leave out of the discussion, you know, younger, there are a number of, you know, children and young people who are caring, and we're not sure how many there are of those. But there's also, you know, a growing group of sort of people in their sort of late 20s, 30s, 40s, who are looking after perhaps a child with long-term disabilities, or a sibling with long-term disabilities, or a partner, because of course people, you could have a stroke, you could have a road traffic accident and be very disabled, and in your 30s or 20s or whatever, and your partner is then sort of expected to sort of step up to the plate and look after you.
There's a really interesting line in the book that talks about the stealthily growing roles of family carers, which seems to hark back on something you've already said, because as those support services dwindle, somebody's got to take up the slack, and it's the family carers who are doing that.
Exactly right, Pete. So in a way, this is where, if I may, we stray squarely into the political territory. When a lot of people would say, well, caring, yes, that's a private choice. It's the family's responsibility to look after their people who are ill and so on, and parents should and partners should and all of this. And we'd all kind of nod and go, yeah, yes. In the abstract sense, of course, it's we all agree with that, wouldn't we? But are we really suggesting that an 85-year-old man or even a 15-year-old child should be doing personal care day in, day out, unsupported for a partner or for a parent? Because that is the reality of what we're talking about. And unless we are willing to honestly have a political and public conversation where we are honestly going to pay for and fund support for family carers, and by that I mean support for the carer, but also support for the person they're looking after, because what a lot of carers would say is, well, I mean, I enjoy going to a support group, which is a common place that carers would go to get help and advice from other carers and from carers, brilliant third sector carer support agencies. But actually often what they also benefit from, of course, is support for the person they're looking after. So carers have been affected, if you like, by so-called austerity. It's a sort of double whammy for them. Services have shrunk down for them, but they've also shrunk down or massively reduced for the person they're looking after. But they're also doing more, actually. So they're doing more care because they're getting less support, but they're also doing more complex care tasks. You know, again, without wishing to sound like I'm really old and it was all lovely in the old days, which of course it wasn't. But, you know, going back to the 80s, there was more community nursing around. There was more home care provided by the local authority, who would be doing care for the people that we're talking about who need the care to be looked after. The carers are now expected to do personal care, and increasingly things like change bandages, you know, monitor medication, monitor pain, drugs, things that are moderately complicated. And actually, nurses certainly do in hospital and used to do in the community. And I really am concerned about the expectation that we now place on family carers to do what are basically quasi-medical tasks. I mean, some people would say, well, some people would argue we should offer carers training. I would counter that by saying, if you're going to train someone to do a complex job, then shouldn't you be paying them?
Yeah, I don't.
Carers don't want, a lot of carers say, I don't want to be paid. I'm happy to do some care. I'm comfortable doing some care. I think it is my job, my role. What I don't want to do is everything unsupported. You know, I'd like to share it with some formal services.
And, you know, I guess one of the things that comes out as well is, you know, we're hearing stories every day almost about local authorities going bust. I spent over 30 years working in a local authority, and that was unheard of when I was working. And we've got this whole thing about care, really. You've got social care looked after by local authorities. You've got health care looked after by the NHS. And surely, you know, it just seems to me, if you landed a Martian here and said, this is our system, they'd say, well, couldn't you have one big budget for all of it?
Absolutely. I mean, you're taking the conversation squarely, aren't you, into the political terrain here. I mean, a national care service is clearly the solution to this challenge, which is only going to get more and more, both in quantity terms. I mean, we are more and more people need social care, for want of a better term. If you go to America and talk about social care, they look baffled. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating an American model of healthcare for sure. But it is really everything that isn't provided by the health service when you boil it down to what is social care. It's just everything else, which is hugely important. It is massively important to people's quality of life and well-being. And there's often people say health and social care as if it's a sort of Johnny-come-lately, a sort of supporter of the health service. And I know lots of academics and practitioners and care workers and family carers who feel very, very, and people who use services who feel very strongly that social care should have a much better press. It should be much better understood. It should be celebrated. There's lots and lots of positive things that social care does. It keeps people alive. It keeps people in the community. It enhances quality of life when it's done well. But you're right. There is something very perverse and complicated and fragmented about the whole care sector. A lot of older people and their carers are just baffled by the whole system. You know, why do I get that from the NHS and somebody comes in a uniform, but they're not a nurse, they're something from a private care agency? How does that? And I seem to be paying for that and having to not paying for that. You're right, it's completely baffling to most people and uneven and unfair, particularly for some groups. Dementia, you know, is the group that have most vocally sort of said, but hang on a minute, I've got a health condition. Why am I paying for my care? And family carers who have dementia would say the same, whereas somebody who perhaps, not always, not a competition, but somebody with perhaps Parkinson's disease or a stroke might get a bit more from the NHS. So I'm not definitely not pitching groups against each other. I'm simply agreeing that there needs to be much more done that brings us together. And a universal care service, a national care service, has got to be the answer, hasn't it?
Well, you know, you would think so, wouldn't you? But just looking at, I mean, picking another statistic out of the book, satisfaction with the current level of support, it was summed up amongst various groups, socioeconomic, et cetera. But generally, I read that as being satisfaction's about 30%, roughly. And I just, you know, well, I have these perverse thoughts. I thought that if you had 30% on eBay, nobody would buy anything. So why is nobody taking notice of the fact that we're talking about changing it, but what's already there is obviously not working?
Well, it's very mixed, isn't it? I mean, there are some absolutely first-class, you know, care providers and very, very committed paid carers alongside very, very committed unpaid carers. But it's very uneven, fragmented. You know, the universal offer doesn't really exist. You know, it's extremely varied across the country, everything from daycare to carer support to care homes. I mean, I was talking to someone earlier today in an unnamed part of England who was saying there's no such thing as a carer support service in this part of England. There just isn't one. So, you know, whereas in quite a lot of places, you know, there are well-known, third sector, well-developed carer support services, but in some places there just aren't any. And that can't be right, can it? So I think there's a whole set of challenges in relationship to the social care sector, Pete, of which supporting carers and the people they're looking after is a key part. I suspect the whole how to change the social care system is perhaps another conversation, but certainly I do feel you're quite right that carers come up against this wall of actually, gosh, what is this sector? And don't forget, we're also talking about a group of people or a populations, plural, of carers, many of whom don't identify at all as a carer. So a policy predicated on, I mean, policy make all these claims, as you well know, about what's, you know, what we ought to be doing in the welfare state, including carers have a right to be recognised and supported and live a life outside caring and so on. Well, carers, a lot of carers would laugh hollowly at the idea that that was what they were actually getting. But of course, it assumes that carers put their hand up quite unproblematically and go, yep, that's me. Whereas a lot of particularly older spouse carers do not see themselves as a carer in the first place, even if they are evidently doing, to the observer, a heck of a lot of hands-on personal care and lifting and handling and washing and dressing and everything else, because that is not how they see their role. They see themselves as a husband or a wife. That's what I'm supposed to be doing. That's my role. So words like carer are kind of antithetical to how that person understands their relationship with the person they may have lived with for sort of 60 odd years. So it's quite a complex. It is quite a complex territory, I think.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that comes out loud and clear in the book. And I guess, you know, also looking at it as well, there's another bit I pulled out of the book, that accurate data on carers, even those people who admit they're carers, you're only going to get every decade through the census.
That's right. In fact, that's a relatively recent addition, you'll be interested to know. I'll have to check my facts on this, and somebody may well ring in and say I'm wrong. But I think it was only 2001 when the census first included a question about caring. Up to that point, it didn't. Now, you can understand to some degree where the census is coming from, because everyone's got their own thing that they think ought to be asked about. Do you know what I mean? So I'm sure they're under huge pressure from all sorts of sources to include all sorts of things. But a massive lobby was made about the huge importance of family caring. And I think it's probably two questions in the census. But again, no doubt someone's going to ring in. And I think they spent a lot of time crafting the question to ensure they captured people who didn't necessarily see themselves as a carer. Are you with me? Because obviously what we want to do is capture people who do caring, whether they call themselves a carer or not. And then I think it was changed a little bit, amended in 2011, and I think amended slightly again in 2021. So I think it's great that we've got it there. Of course, Carers UK do regular surveys. There are regular surveys done by them at least. And then there's reasonably good levels of, I would say, probably local data on carers. But very early. And to go back to your levels of satisfaction for a second, I mean, unless we actually tackle the issue of how to fund and create a welfare state, a proper care service that actually does meaningfully meet the needs of people who need care and support and their family carers, I can't believe that satisfaction will necessarily go up much.
Yeah, that's...
Can I just also add, I definitely don't want to appear to be having a go at individual carers, paid carers here, because actually they are, I mean, again, the book, we are talking about family carers, but we also do acknowledge that particularly around gender, there is a big intersection between the paid care workforce and the unpaid care workforce, that women, generally speaking, it's women who work on the front line of the care services, and they're underpaid, under-recognised, poorly treated. I mean, look at the COVID example. You know, these were women that were continuing to work in care homes without proper protection, on a minimum wage, you know, not necessarily well supervised, not necessarily well supported, and there isn't a career structure, la la la. So actually, yes, there's a lot of care workers do fantastic work for which they're not recognised or rewarded, really.
Yeah, you know, I would echo that. Having read the book, very complimentary about those people that, you know, are great in doing those services. I mean, you mentioned the COVID word there. With what's going to come out of the COVID inquiry eventually, you know, do you think that's going to have an impact on the whole carer world?
That's a very good question, actually. I mean, obviously, during COVID, quite a lot of people who hadn't hitherto particularly been involved in care activities in the family settings became involved because care services obviously withdrew for reasons that, you know, we both know. And I'm not confident, I know exactly, but someone may ring in and tell me, how many of those people continued to be carers after COVID. I suspect quite a few did. But I do know of quite a lot of people, not only who began to be carers, if you like, although that, again, is a movable feast, during COVID, but also people that had to do much more. So people who perhaps had a son or a daughter with severe learning disabilities who might have been getting some daycare support or some respite care support, who didn't get that during COVID, who ended up doing much more care. And of course, we both know, Pete, and this takes us back to the local authority cuts, that for quite a lot of places, they didn't reopen those services, or they reopened them on a much lower level or much reduced level, leaving people doing more care than they had when they first came into the pandemic. I mean, I know that there's a lot of concern, I think, about the social care workforce having been effectively abandoned, really, during... I mean, I've written about this myself in a piece about care homes. You know, they were very much sort of, oh, yeah, oh, gosh, we sort of forgot about them, oh, dear. And all that stuff about protective ring around care homes. Well, I think we now know that there was no such thing. And home care workers were exposed as well, again, with a very varied access to sort of PPE and so on. So this was a workforce that was definitely, you know, exposed, and we should really be doing much more to learn the lessons from COVID. At the moment, I can't see much evidence we have done.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
This is the D-Word podcast with my guest, Alison Milne.
Well, exactly. You know, I think it's a sad conclusion. It seems to be, well, we've forgotten about that and move on. But one of the other things that comes out for me, and I hadn't really thought of this, was the separation in policy between carers and the people they care for. And I've suddenly thought back to this. When I was with the Alzheimer's Society, we had activity groups for people living with dementia in the community, and we used to get that person. We used to have a good time with them throughout the day. But I don't think the knock-on effect of how effective that was for the carers, who then went out and got their hair done, went shopping or whatever. And I sort of thought that was a really good point, that we don't often think about and treat it more or less as a team, the person that is being cared for and the carer.
Absolutely. So it's a funny sort of legacy, really, of how policy's been developed, I think, mainly, Pete. I mean, you know, it only since the Care Act, 2014 Care Act, have carers had a right to ask for an assessment. They can... Or anyone who thinks they're a carer, again, we're back to labelling, but that to one side, can ask to have an assessment of need. Now, we know that actually very few carers do ask for that. It's really quite a low number. And after you've had an assessment, you may be eligible for some support from your local authority. Of course, if you've got too much money to get that, you would be expected to go out and fund your own care, as it were. The same really applies to the person they're looking after, but they have developed in slightly separate sort of parallel universes, if you like. And the person with, that now we talk about the person with care and support needs, you know, way back when would have been covered by legislation in a number of different guises. Now, you could say, well, it was always a movable feast, and that's true, it always was. But of course, we're now talking about more people being under the umbrella of people with care and support needs. There are more of them in any given area. But you're right that in a way we've sort of almost developed this separation, which is bonkers when a carer is only a carer because they're looking after somebody who's basically sitting next to them or is in the next room or has gone out to a day service for the day or something along those lines. We seem to be beginning to think about caring. I'll use the term dyadic context, meaning two people together. And I use the term dyad rather than couple because, of course, it might be a mother and son. It might be a two siblings. And so, in other words, dyad is just two people. it might be a husband and wife or a long-term partnership. But we are beginning to think about the needs of a dyad, but it's a little bit complicated because systems, particularly local authority systems, have developed this quite separate set of issues, budgets, forms, you know, and so on. And you, so in a way, we, I mean, I've done some work with some colleagues on looking at dyadic assessment. And you, as you say, you'd think it'd be obvious, but it sort of isn't because of this history, really. But yes, I think that's a really important point and one I would like to do more on, really, and to think about more. Because actually, you're, if you're looking after your wife or partner, your partner, you know, your needs and the way you live your life is intertwined with that person, isn't it, in a way? And if you were sort of hived off and your needs were assessed and your partner's needs were assessed, you'd say, well, that's a bit bonkers because he might need that, but on a Tuesday I'm doing this. So it's, you know, yeah, it's a bit of a no-brainer to think, let's try. And the other challenge, Pete, is that because of the neoliberal market model, where local authorities, as you know, now actually provide quite little. They can mainly commission services, what's called outsourcing. Although, interestingly, there's now a move to insourcing, which we can talk about if you want. So anyway, so going back to the sort of late 80s, 90s and beyond, the local authority was expected to outsource most of its services. So it's outsourced carer services over here, and it's outsourced services for the person with care and support needs over here. So you've got another challenge there. And I just want to, again, reiterate, I'm not having a go at services. Services are there often against all odds doing a fantastic job. But carers' agencies are tasked with supporting the carer, and sometimes they're commissioned to do carers' needs assessments, statutory assessments for the local authority. But they're not tasked with taking account of the needs of the person that's being looked after. So, you've got this reinforcement of the kind of parallel universes.
Yeah, it does baffle me to think about. I think of what my dad used to say, and they need to use a bit of common, was what my dad would have said, in terms of you kind of detach yourself from all the politics and everything, and you look at it and think, well, surely there's a bit of common sense here.
Well, who is it you think should be employing the common sense, Pete?
Oh, I don't think we've got that long, Alice. So I think that's the problem. We're running out of time here. But,
yeah, that's true. Good point.
I'm not usually on the end of the questions, but I would say those that are making the policy, because the policy kind of kicks everything off. So, let's have a common sense approach. Let's look at what we've got and how we're going to get through it. And I suppose the other thing, being controversial, I suppose I can, is let's take politics out of it. Let's get everybody working together, because I think this is a national crisis.
I don't think you can do that, actually. And I think the tighter the reins, the worse it is. Because in the end, people just do end up, I'm afraid, watching the purse. Now, that's not how I think it should be. Of course I don't. But the tighter the reins are, the worse it seems to be. And also there's a sort of inverse relationship between the bigger the talk up here about integrated working and all that stuff, the worse it is at the sort of front line. Because if you starve local authorities of cash, and you literally starve them to the point of bankruptcy, as you said earlier in the discussion, then, you know, it's very, very difficult to envisage or feel that you can be free enough, unfettered enough by financial concerns to have an open, honest conversation with your partners, which might be the NHS, it might be a third sector organisation, it might be a council or a local authority, because in the end it is quite challenging. I'm not saying it shouldn't happen, but I think it's easy to say and actually quite hard to do.
Well, I think that's probably the point we'll leave it. I think we need to come back and discuss things more. Very much enjoyed having you on the show, Alison. Good luck with the book, because I think it's an excellent read. And thanks so much for being my guest.
Not at all. I really enjoyed it. Nice to talk to you, Pete, and I'll come back anytime. As you can see, I can talk about carers a lot. Take care.
Thanks to Alison for such an informative chat. The book, co-written with Mary Larkin, is Family Carers and Caring, What's It All About? It's part of the Society Now series published by Emerald Publishing. That's it for another podcast. Hope you've enjoyed it, and you'll join me again soon for some more Dementia Talk.